Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
I will be reading Nehemiah 4, 1 through 6. Nehemiah 4, 1 through 6. Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, "Even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down. Hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for the plunder in the land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity and let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work."
As we've gone through the year, focusing on a different verse each month for a reminder of our faith, this month we're thinking about this passage from John, an explanation about the role of faith in believing the one who the Father had sent. Let's say this together. "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent." John 6:29. You know, there's an old saying, a proverb, that has really made the rounds over the years. It shows up in different forms, in different literature throughout the centuries. And here is one that maybe you're familiar with. "For the want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For the want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For the want of a horse, the rider was lost. For the want of a rider, the message was lost. For the want of a message, the battle was lost. For the want of a battle, the kingdom was lost. And all for the want of a horseshoe nail." Maybe you've heard that before. It's a reminder for us that even though you might be in a big battle, and even though it might seem like the real arena where things are happening are the places where people have weapons and where they're really attacking each other, that sometimes it's the really small things. Sometimes it's the little things that might seem insignificant that have a huge impact. For the want of a horseshoe nail, there's a whole series of events that turns the tide of a battle. Sometimes it's not something big. Sometimes it's small. I'm one of those people who enjoys learning more about the recent decades of NASA and space exploration. And I'm always interested that when we see movies about space and what it might be like out there, and kind of science fiction movies, the danger is that there's always a battle with someone else. There's always an external force, you know, that aliens from another planet might come and battle us. Sometimes we don't think about even the dangers that can occur from other sources. If you think about the Apollo 13 mission to the moon, had to be abandoned because of a malfunction, a short circuit initially caused by a piece of equipment that people estimate being worth just about 50 cents, 75 cents. Something small went wrong, caused a big problem. Sometimes small things can cause serious issues. Think for just a moment about growing up. About what life was like for you growing up, talking with your friends, maybe even getting into arguments with your friends. Now, maybe it's different for guys than girls, but sometimes when you were growing up, if you were in an argument, There might be a little pushing. There might be a little shoving. You know, you might kind of be a little forceful. Even at school growing up, there were times when there'd be some fights in the school hallway. Nothing really serious when I was growing up, but you'd still see some people were trying to solve things that way. You know, what's interesting is I don't remember very many details about those moments. I don't remember very many details about seeing someone else kind of in a fight or a little bit of a wrestling match over something, pushing and shoving. But I can remember vividly things that were said. I can remember things that were said to me. Can't you remember some of those? I won't ask us to share those, but I can imagine just by even bringing this up, there are some phrases that are echoing in your mind because you remember hearing things that made an impact on you. And it's often been said that the old phrase, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, isn't really accurate, especially not in the world we live in today. Words will really never hurt me? You mean the kind of words that you can't escape by leaving work or school because through the miracle of technology, you can see those words everywhere? That you can see what something says about you everywhere? And then when you see what's been said, that can also be joined in with another chorus of voices online? It seems like it should be such a small thing, just a throwaway comment that someone says. But if it hits us just right, it sticks with us. And even if we've gotten to a point where we've forgiven that person and we've grown and we understand where that person was coming from and we see the things that were going on in that person's life, we still remember the words because they're not small things. We can see the evidence of that even in the culture around us, in the rates of anxiety, of self-harm, even suicide that are rising. And there are a lot of connections. There's likely not one main reason, but there are a lot of connections to the way in which people sometimes feel like they can't escape what has been said about them. There's an oppression as they're trying to figure out, how do I live my life knowing these words could come at me from anywhere? That online people can say anything. Words seem like small things, but they're really not. It's interesting that as we've gone through Hebrews chapter 11, we've looked at some pretty powerful moments in the history of God's people. We've thought about what it meant to build an ark to navigate this flood that God sent. We've thought about what it was like for Moses to lead the Israelites across the Red Sea. We've thought about what it was like for David to stand up to a giant. But this morning, I just want to remind us, sometimes it's not a giant. Sometimes it's not a fiery furnace. Sometimes it's not a den of hungry lions. Sometimes it seems smaller. And I think that may be one of the reasons when you're flipping through the pages of Hebrews chapter 11, it's not just the big stuff that gets listed. It's not just the imprisonment. It's not just the stoning and left for dead. Hebrews 11 also says in verse 36, as describing these individuals of faith, some experienced mockings. Now, initially, we're thinking, wait a minute, this doesn't really match the list. You're telling me that lining up with David facing off with Goliath, or lining up with Noah building an ark for something that no one else around him believed was going to happen aside from his family, or could even have any form of reference to previously in their lives, you're saying that lines up with experiencing mockings. If we dismiss something that seems so small, I think we're dismissing a powerful tool that Satan can use. So I want us to think for a few minutes this morning about what we do when we deal with discouragement. When we face discouragement and mocking and insults, yes, maybe it's not being thrown in prison or thrown in a den of lions, but isn't there something serious that happens there? Isn't there something long-term that could happen? And sometimes that's even related to our faith. Sometimes we even receive insults because we're stepping out and trying to do something in faith. And so we live in a world where if you're talking to someone about what you believe, convictions that are something you hold to your core, someone would say, well, you know, that's really a fairy tale. Not everything in the Bible, that's just kind of myth. That's easily dismissible. Well, what do I do then? Or if someone insults just the way in which I seek to live my life, the things that I want to do, and they say, you know, those things, that's just common sense tells us that's not a big deal. You think this is still important? You still have this restrictive attitude that says this? You're so narrow-minded that you still think this matters? Well, you just don't have common sense. That's not the way the world works. We've evolved beyond that. How do I respond? We live in a world today where I read that this past year, there's a comic book that came out, and one of the characters is a superhero named Sun Man, and one of the characters is Jesus. And the premise of this comic book is that Jesus failed in his mission when he came to Earth, so he sent back to learn from a superhero how to really be a hero in people's lives. That's the world we're living in, where something that is so important to me, the identity and nature of who Jesus is, that matters to me. And it's not just because I'm a minister. That should matter to all of us, shouldn't it? And yet we live in a world where that could be used as just a cheap laugh or a joke. That's where we live. Now, we don't want to necessarily be upset with the culture around us for being the culture. We can't control that. We can control how we respond to that. We can look around and say, I wish things were different. I wish I weren't getting this kind of discouragement. Wish I weren't getting this kind of insult. But ultimately, the only people we can control are ourselves. The only thing I can do is choose how I'm going to react. And if I'm thinking along those lines, I'm in a good frame of mind to think about what happens in Nehemiah chapter 4. Nehemiah was on a mission. And from the very beginning of the book, we find out that even though God's people have been in exile, in Babylonian captivity, and then later in Persian captivity, Nehemiah has risen, even though he is has his roots in Jerusalem. He has risen in this new culture to a very prominent position. He was the cupbearer to the king. That likely indicates not only a good lifestyle, living in the palace, but he evidently has the trust of the king. And yet he hears what life is like in Jerusalem. He hears what the city that was once so proud, that once had the temple where people went to worship God, now looks like. And so the beginning of the book tells us how he's struck in his heart to try to figure out, what should I do? He develops a plan, and he goes before the king, is sad before the king, which is not something you did in the presence of a king, but the king asks him the question. He responds and says, here's what's happening. I want to do something about that. Now, it's interesting to see the different approaches from kingdoms over the years. When Assyria wanted to take the Israelites, the northern kingdom, captive, they did that, and their goal was to take them in, and they would scatter them out so they couldn't reform. They would take them in among them, and they'd become Assyrians, and they'd scatter them so that no one would be left. That's not exactly the way the Babylonians did it when they got the southern kingdom. They wanted to take what they had and have those people, the cream of the crop, the best and the brightest, become Babylonians, but they left some folks back to take care of the land. This was now their territory. Someone had to take care of it. And so when the Persians come along and now they're in control, they do something totally different. They say, why don't we let people go back to where they're from, go back to their homeland, as long as they're paying taxes to us, as long as they're loyal to us, we'll let them live there. And so Nehemiah takes advantage of this approach. He not only asks the king for an extended period of time to go to Jerusalem, he asks for a lot of resources. He shows up, goes to the city, looks around and sees what needs to be done, and he begins to rebuild a wall, a sense of their identity, a sense of who they used to be. It's their national identity as the people of God. It's about more than just something physical. There's a spiritual element here. And so as he gets the people to begin building it, he gets on the bad side of local surrounding leaders. And as Landry just read for us, they have some insults for him. I'd like for us to look at those first few verses of Nehemiah chapter 4 and really focus in on some of the insults here. So we're introduced in verse 1 to Sanballat, who becomes very furious and very angry and mocks the Jews. Isn't it interesting that when he becomes furious and angry, his first go-to move is to mock his enemies. Boy, that's true, isn't it? Sometimes that's our first move when we're so angry and we just want to make fun of someone. We want to ridicule someone. And he says, what are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can you just hear how this is dripping with sarcasm and with hatred? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they do all this at once? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones? And then Tobiah the Ammonite is near him and he gets in on the action. Even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down. Nehemiah has done everything right at this point. He has taken on an incredible challenge, and he's done it to honor God, and now he's getting insults. These kind of criticisms would have been incredibly hurtful to the people who were building. It may not sound that way to us, but if you notice that sometimes people can say things, and maybe if someone said this something specific to you, it wouldn't really insult you, but if they said it to someone else, and that's a real sore spot, it could really get to them. Take just a moment. Again, you don't have to tell anybody that's sitting next to you. But what are those areas in your life? Those areas, if someone says this, if they push this particular button, it's just almost like it's hard to think straight anymore. That's what's happening here. We can tell that because we see in Scripture, in 2 Kings 25, there were some left in Jerusalem. Verse 12 says, the ones that were left behind when everyone was taken captive were the poorest in the land, and they would stay there just to take care of the land. And so these leaders come back and say, this crew, this is who you're going to rebuild the wall with? What are these feeble Jews doing? That would have hurt. They knew they weren't the ones that were taken in captive. They knew they had been living this depressing life of it, living in the shadow of what Jerusalem had been. And now someone is insulting them and they're getting them right at the heart of that. They were insulting their sacrifices. That's another sore spot. Because when Jerusalem was invaded, when the Babylonians came in, they took what was in their temple. And so the bronze pillars, the previous metals in the vessels used in temple worship were carried off by Babylon. So they're saying, oh, really? Now you're going to offer sacrifices? Tell me how this is going to work out. So Nehemiah is having to deal with threats from without. A couple of chapters later, two leaders, right as they're getting close to finishing the wall, will send a letter to Nehemiah asking him to come meet them. Come out and meet with us. Now, the text doesn't say Nehemiah knows exactly what they were planning, but I think he had a good idea. They were wanting to lure him out, to attack him. And then when he doesn't respond, when he says, sorry, I'm busy, I'm doing a great work, I can't come down, then they send an open letter that's accusing him of various things, trying to build the wall, trying to obtain power, and trying to seek and wrest power from the people so he could be in charge. It wasn't true, but they were trying to circulate the rumor. They even hired someone to convince him to go into the temple because they were coming to attack him, trying to goad him into doing something that he wasn't supposed to do. Not only that, but he has to deal with issues from within too. He has to deal with other Jews who were now trying to take advantage of some of those who were poor. Even Jews that were taking their own countrymen into slavery. And he's got to deal with that among the nobles and the princes and say, this isn't right. In the midst of all this, how does Nehemiah handle it? How do we handle it? How do we handle it when all we're trying to do is just something that's right? All we're trying to do is stand up for God, and it just seems like from every side and from every angle, there's nothing but ridicule and discouragement. Here are a couple of things Nehemiah shows us. He made some key choices here. And the first is he chooses prayer over retaliation. It seems to me that it matters that Nehemiah, instead of lashing out at these people who are offering insults, he chooses to pray. Now, his prayer is interesting, isn't it? Did you catch what he prayed in verse 4? He says, hear, O God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in the land of captivity. That sounds pretty harsh, doesn't it? He goes on to say, do not forgive their iniquity And let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders. Now talk about a harsh statement. Nehemiah chooses to pray, but he actually prays that they wouldn't be forgiven. How do we deal with that? It's really similar to what we find in the Psalms. There are several Psalms where the psalmist prays what some have called imprecatory Psalms. In other words, trying to call down some kind of curse on the enemy. Saying, you need to not only defeat my enemies, I've got some ideas as to how I want that to happen. What can we take from that? Well, we got to remember a couple of things. Number one, we do remember that Nehemiah is living in a different time than we are, in the sense that his mission is to give some identity to God's people, and that God's people were a nation, and the nation had enemies, and so God's going to accomplish his will of sending his son into the world through this particular people. But I think it's also significant that he is leaving the duty of vengeance to God. He doesn't take matters into his own hands. He doesn't say, I'll tell you what I'm going to blot out. I'm going to blot out these people. He says, God, this is your responsibility. Now, he makes some serious suggestions. Have there ever been times you've prayed and you've made some suggestions as to how you wanted something to be handled and it didn't work out that way? It seems to me that God is probably well-versed in hearing human beings pray things that they wish would happen, and God knowing what's best. So I'm not saying we model our prayers exactly after what Nehemiah prays for here. I do think it's significant that he went to God in prayer before going to his enemies in retaliation. That's the core of his action here that I think is important to us. Because the easiest thing in the world to do, and sometimes the most immediately satisfying thing to do, is to lash out at someone else. But by staying faithful to God, he was able to overcome the insults. He was able not to let them control his actions. I've mentioned before that one of my favorite movies has been Back to the Future. The original one. The other two aren't bad, but the original one, I mean, that's the one that really stands out in my mind. And the main character in Back to the Future, Marty McFly, is a pretty good guy. But he has a verbal kryptonite, something that if it's said to him, he all of a sudden can't control his actions. And that's when someone calls him chicken. They say that if someone says he's chicken, he turns around and he's going to fight no matter what. And so all three of the movies, you're rooting for the guy, but you're wanting, every time someone says that, you just want to yell at the screen, let it go, don't worry about it. Because by saying that, they're controlling his actions. You know, if I allow people to dictate how I respond by retaliating immediately when they say something to me, I'm putting them in control. And guess what? If discouragement is one of the tools Satan, also called in Scripture the accuser, uses, well, who's in control when I'm responding to those insults instead of going to God first in prayer? Psalm 42 in verse 5 shows us this tension. Why are you in despair, O my soul? And why have you become disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him for the help of his presence. What do we do when we feel despair in our soul? The psalmist says, I focus on God. I go to him. I take a breath. I take a beat. Instead of doing what I might want to do at the moment, I go to God in prayer. It's a little bit like stopping to count to 10 before you respond, except this time we're going to the one who knows exactly what we're experiencing, exactly what we should do, and can guide us through those situations. You know, we had an incredible blessing yesterday as part of giveaway day. One of the neat areas that we had was to offer people the chance to pray with them about something that might be on their mind or on their hearts. I don't know if there's any picture from yesterday that I found more encouraging than watching from afar as individuals from this congregation would pray with people that they just met. And one thing I noticed was that when people were offered prayers, sure, there were some who said, no, thank you, I'm not interested in that. But there were many who recognized the need for prayer and the need for specific prayer. There were things in their lives they knew were important to pray about. I think that should be a challenge to us. How many times do I stop in my life and know, acknowledge to myself, I need to pray about this? I don't just need to do something about it. I don't just need to figure out how I'm going to respond. What am I going to say? I need to pray about it. He chose prayer over retaliation. And when Paul would write to the church at Rome and would say, don't take vengeance, because the Lord says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. You leave that up to God. Nehemiah is already modeling that for us. He chose prayer over retaliation, and he also chose mission over distraction. Instead of meeting with these opponents in chapter 6 who were trying to lure him away from what he's doing, he kept working. It's interesting, too, if you look at chapter 6, you find out that they were getting pretty close to the end of their rebuilding efforts. And sometimes when we get close to accomplishing something, that's when it seems like Satan redoubles his efforts. And all of a sudden, we get more distractions coming our way. We get more challenges coming our way. And Nehemiah refused to be distracted. He said, I'm doing a great work. I just don't have time to come down and to deal with distraction. Sometimes an effective tool for discouragement is just to focus on our mission and to say, you know, I'm not going to take time for this. If there's a serious issue that needs to be dealt with, we're usually able to tell when it's a serious issue or when it's just an insult, when someone's seeking to discourage us. And he's saying, I don't have time to invest the resources of manpower and man hours in this to talk to someone else. I've got to focus on accomplishing this. It's important because staying on mission helped him to avoid disaster. We don't know exactly what would have happened if he'd allowed himself to be drawn away, to be alone with them, but we know it wouldn't have been good because that was not their intention. Staying on mission helped him avoid all kinds of pitfalls along the way. Focus is incredibly important when I'm serving God. He chose prayer over retaliation, and he chose his mission over distraction. So now's the point where we have to ask ourselves, what does my life look like if I'm making these choices? I don't know what you're dealing with. Chances are there's something discouraging you. It might be external, as we've talked about. Nehemiah had to deal with some internal strife as well. Maybe it's internal. Maybe the insults aren't coming from outside. Maybe they're rattling around in your mind as you're thinking to yourself, I'll never be able to accomplish this. I'll never be able to do this. What do we choose? Do I choose prayer over retaliation? Are there times in your life when you have done something or said something just to get back at someone, just to respond to them? If you had to put a percentage on it, what percentage of those times did you do or say things in response to someone else that you're really proud of? Thought about that? What percentage of those times did you think, I'm really glad I said that? You know, I gave them a piece of my mind, and that was the right, holy, kind, loving thing to do. I think if you're like me, my number is pretty lopsided for things I wish I'd never said. It might feel good to retaliate, but if I haven't stopped to prayerfully consider my response, I could wind up regretting something and making things even worse. Will I choose mission or distraction? Maybe there's something good that I need to get accomplished. Maybe I've got my day set out and there's something that needs to happen, but someone says something at work, and that comment just sets me off, and I spend all day trying to think what I can go back and say to that person. Maybe someone posts something online, and I think, I just can't believe what they've done. I'll tell you what, I'm going to, and this is, and I'm telling you because I've been in this trap before, so I'm with you here on this. We think to ourselves, you know, I'm going to craft the perfect response, right? How many of us have ever thought that on social media, and how many of us have ever done that? Has there ever been a social media post or comment that has solved an issue? I don't know if there has been. Maybe there has been. But I know what, more often than not, I've gone further than I meant to, said more than I should have, maybe even acted in a way that I shouldn't. And I've thought, you know, I just need to focus on my mission. There will always be discouragers. Choosing prayer, choosing mission, this is what Nehemiah did. And it's true that the wall was not made by a group of professional builders. And it was true that they had weapons in their hand as they were building. They weren't offensive, but they were defensive. They were ready. If they were going to be attacked, they were ready. But they built it. It was accomplished. God was with them. I don't know what you're facing in your life. I know it's important to be ready because Satan is going to attack us. But I also know if we can choose prayer, if we can choose God's mission instead of following our own agenda, God will lead us to things that we can never have accomplished on our own. There's an old story that gets told often, sometimes in sermons, sometimes in devotional books. I think it's pretty powerful. It's a fictional tale of what it would be like if Satan were having a sale and he put all his weapons on display. And for the right price, you could purchase them. And there's pride, and there's selfishness, and there's jealousy, and there's lust. And all of them have various price tags. Some are very expensive. They're bright, shiny tools. They seem incredibly powerful. But in the corner, there's a little wedge-shaped tool. And it's worn, and it's beaten down. It doesn't look like it's worth more than a few dollars, but it was priced much higher than any of the others. Someone asked why. And he said, well, that tool right there is discouragement. And I've used that so often, I'm amazed it still works. But I can pry open people's hearts. And once they're discouraged, I can get in there and I can get them to do all kinds of things. That's why it's so expensive. And as the story goes, it was too expensive for anyone else to buy. And so he's kept it. It's a tool that Satan uses. It's a challenge that we face. Our decision is, are we going to choose God? It may be that this morning, in the midst of your discouragement, you need to rededicate your life to God. That you've begun along the way, but somewhere you've lost the way, and you need to make that right. It may be that you need to begin with your very first choice to choose God. Choosing to live a life for Him, to put Christ on in baptism, to become a child of God that seeks to allow Him to direct your paths. If we can help you in prayer, we'd love for you to pray with us. If you'd like to pray with a couple of our shepherds, right after this worship service, through that doorway, there'd be a couple of them that would love to sit down and pray with you and for you. No matter where we are, let's choose God today. If we can help in any way, please come as we stand, as we sing together.